Well, welcome everybody to the second episode of Social Europe Talk. Today we're going to discuss Britain in Europe after the general election of May the 7th, which produced a very surprising result. With me today is Richard Corbett, MEP from Yorkshire, and also formerly a member of the cabinet of Herman Van Rompuy. Dennis McShane, who's written this book about Brexit just before the election and who was the Europe Minister in Tony Blair's government. And Armindo Silva, formerly of the European Commission and Director for Social Legislation in DG Employment and Social Affairs. So, what the first question would be to Richard. What do you make of the election result and where do you think does this leave Britain and Europe?
The result came as a shock to many people. I think Labour's message was perhaps too diverse. We were addressing a dozen different issues, each targeted perhaps at somewhat different audiences. The Conservatives stuck to a very clear central message, at least in the last 2 weeks. One of those messages addressed another aspect of this campaign, which is what happened in Scotland with the rise of the SNP. And they played on that as a fear factor towards English voters, saying that Labour without Scotland won't have an absolute majority, so they will be dependent on the SNP, they will be in hock to Alex Salmond, the SNP leader, and use that as a scare tactic in England, which was another factor contributing to us doing less well than expected.
Okay, and now that the result is here and the Conservative government has a majority and the renegotiation starts, where do you think this is going?
Well, Cameron's problems start now. He's got a very narrow majority and a party, let's not forget, that remains bitterly divided on Europe. How have we come to this situation of this proposed renegotiation reform followed by a referendum? It was, after all, not because it's a matter of great principle to him, but because it had not originally not been his policy. It was to keep his rather divided party together until after the election. You know, we'll sort this out after the election and we'll let the people decide in a referendum. It could keep all the factions of his party together. Because on the far right of his party are those who want to leave the European Union under any circumstances. On the more moderate wing, or those closer to business, there are those who think this is all a little bit risky. Now, pro-European Conservatives still exist, there may not be many of them. I suggested recently that they be listed under the CITES Convention of the United Nations as an endangered species and afforded particular protection against the very vicious predators they have in their own party. But they will, I think, now be sticking their head above the parapet as well. And so the Conservative civil war on Europe will come out much more into the open. And the right wing will be trying to bounce him into making impossible demands of our European partners. He will start off, I think, cautiously in that respect, modestly, but they will be pushing him all the while, all the time, to make ever more difficult demands.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, in this book that was published just before the general election in the UK, you refer to a few meta-trends, if you would like to call them that. What are these meta-trends and how do they play out now the result is out?
Very simply, the book is an analysis. It's a political historical analysis of all the tributaries. Meta-trends is a very nice modern term, but I prefer to call them currents or tributaries that are hostile to Europe in our political life. We have UKIP, this important new party. It got 30% of the vote in the election. It got 25% of the vote in the European Parliament elections. A huge reservoir of votes. It's elected a number of local councillors, even though it didn't win any MP seats, certainly not for its leader, Nigel Farage. But they're back in business because UKIP had two big demands in its existence. One, a referendum. Two, a vote to get out of Europe. David Cameron has given them the first, and now they're going to focus on the second. We've got our press, owned largely by men who don't live in Britain, don't pay taxes in Britain, Rupert Murdoch, the people who own The Telegraph, The Daily Mail. Are they going to suddenly change 20 years of anti-European campaigning? I doubt it. We have a lot of business, not so much big international global business, the people we read about in the Financial Times and the posh papers. Lots of small businesses have been told, well, it's this European regulation of working time or posted workers directive or something else, social Europe, is messing up your chance to be successful profit-taking businessmen. And again, I just think all of these currents, if they come together, where the prime minister in 2 or even 1 year's time is very unpopular, then you just have to look at the other European referendums in this century. Sweden, France, Denmark, Netherlands, Ireland, and they've all been no votes. So I remain very, very worried that with Mr. Cameron now initiating the first plebiscite in my lifetime that allows a European nation to leave, not stop a treaty or stop a treaty change or opt out of something, actually leave an international treaty organisation. This is very big politics, and we should understand just how serious it might turn into.
Arminda, one of the key battlegrounds is basically the issue of treaty change. But from a purely procedural perspective, it's very hard to see how this can be achieved. If the referendum is in 2016 or even 2017 or 2016 even, as some people are discussing, even if treaty change were agreed on very quickly, the implementation would mean it would take longer than that. And if there's no treaty change, even though other European countries might be able or willing to do treaty change, the Prime Minister in a referendum couldn't promise because it would have to be ratified by all member states. So what do you think? Is there any option of treaty change? And if not, where is the room for maneuver?
I think it is unrealistic to think of changes that imply modifications in the treaty, not only given the very tight timeline we have, because any treaty change would have to be approved by the 28 member states, and in some of them, referenda are necessary. But perhaps more substantially than that, because some of the changes that the UK is considering would be certainly opposed by other member states. I'm thinking particularly of changes that would modify the discrimination on the basis of nationality or the equal treatment of workers, which would be opposed by many member states, particularly those that are origin of migrants into the UK. Also, the repatriation of competences in the employment chapter would be opposed by, I think, a very large majority of member states that would consider that as an incentive to distortions in competition, social dumping, and would create the idea that the UK labour market would be more flexible and have less cost for business than the others. That would work as a magnet for attraction for foreign investment, which countries like France, Italy or Germany certainly would not like. So I think that those proposals are unrealistic, not only because of the tight timeline, but also because of its own substance that goes right against the strategic interests of many member states for different reasons.
Mm-hmm. And some people are mentioning the idea that you base the availability of benefits not on nationality but on residency for a certain period of time. Say you only qualify for certain benefits if you've been a resident of the UK for, say, 4 years. Would that be compatible, or is it too obvious that this is a benefit for the indigenous population and effectively discriminates against others?
Oh, in my view, it runs totally contrary to Article 45 and Article 18 of the treaty. Because it would create a situation of effective discrimination against workers coming from other member states who would be less well treated than nationals. Although they pay taxes and work for 4 years, they will not have the same rights. So not only the treaty, but the jurisprudence of the court is very clear on that. On the interpretation of those articles, and that would be discriminatory, yes. So it would oblige, in my view, to a treaty change. Mm-hmm. It's not compatible with Article 45.
Richard, if you can rule out treaty change and you see these sort of impediments against other change, where do you see the wiggle room? Where do you see this going?
Well, there is ample scope for reforming the EU without changing the treaties. Indeed, I would argue that that's what the EU does day in, day out is reform, and you need to get stuck in that process and reform. We had the significant reform of the common fisheries policy 2 years ago. We've recently had big reform of financial sector regulation and markets. We're now embarking on creating a single digital market in Europe. That's what these institutions do day in, day out. It's us and our neighbouring countries around a table working out common solutions to common problems, not least the common rules for our common market. That's what we do. The idea that you suddenly come up with a set of reforms that you define in 2015, you negotiate in 2016, you ratify in 2017, and then it's done forevermore and we can all go home and be happy, is a preposterous idea.
Is more reform along the lines that you've already mentioned, is that going to be enough for Cameron to sell in the UK?
I think it could well be enough for him to sell to the wider public. His challenge will be selling it to his backbench, the right-wing part of his party, the more Eurosceptic part of his party. They want, and they are demanding, treaty change precisely to make it more difficult for him.
Dennis, if you were the British Prime Minister, what would your negotiation line be?
Well, I wouldn't be having a referendum, period, because I think plebiscites transfer power from Parliament and elected people to rich men who finance campaigns, to press proprietors, whoever they are, and to populist passions. And I think we should divorce the technical argument over what Mr. Cameron may ask for, what he may obtain, and actually looking at what seems to be the British list of demands, it's far more modest than a year ago. I was just earlier talking to a Conservative MEP, and he said, well, there'll have to be controls on freedom of movement. Britain will have to be able to stop Poles or Bulgarians or Portuguese coming in, or perhaps we've had 2,000 this month, we won't have any more until 2 months' time. It's, you have people on EasyJet saying, sorry, we're not flying any more foreigners into Britain. It's a ludicrous notion. But that's what he believes, and he's a moderate Conservative MEP. So, but quite separately from that, I think you have to look at the referendum and the plebiscite as a process, because that will have very little to do with Europe. It'll be about anger and discontent and dislike of the government. Look in the Scottish referendum. It was the hatred of the London elites, the Westminster elites. I assume, I was talking to a Labour MEP colleague friend earlier, and she said, well, get it over quickly. We must all stay together to stay in Europe. I agree with her, but I'm not sure if everybody on the left wants to give Mr. Cameron a victory. So once you get into the referendum territory, all sorts of other factors come into play.
So you wouldn't have a referendum in the first place, but now...
Now we've got to have one. Well, I like Macbeth. If it were done, twirl well, it were done quickly. I would say, get it over and done with. I'm sure this goodwill, nobody wants Britain to leave. I mean, we'll have a sort of Britain floating around outside the Europe being unpleasant, and we've got a Mr. Putin floating around on the other side being unpleasant. Nobody wants Britain to leave. Mr. Cameron is a bit like Alexis Tsipras from Syriza in Greece, elected with 36% of the vote, and then he says, right, I've got a mandate, you must all drop your rules, bend your rules, be flexible, accept whatever we want. And the rest of Europe has to decide, you know, how much you can bend rules. But anyway, I would get a package together and I'd say to the Conservative Party, look, we're not going to take Britain out of Europe. We're not going to be the government that isolates Britain. We're not going to be the only nation in the last 100 years, other than the Germans in 1933, that leaves a major international treaty organisation. And we say to business, you've got a Conservative government. We're pro-business. You put your money in there. And you say to UKIP and any of the press that want to be ugly, a bit like Prince Hal does at the end of Henry IV about Falstaff, fall to thy knees, old man, how ill anti-European hairs become an old man. He didn't quite say that. And just Cameron stands up, crushes the anti-European opposition, wins his little victory. And you know something? Nothing will have changed. All the British moans and groans about Europe will still be there the day after the referendum, but I hope, obviously, we vote to stay in.
I mean, though, given the experience you've had in also dealing with the UK amongst other member states and the European Commission, where do you actually see some wriggle room? Are there any areas where, you know, the demands of Cameron can be met to some extent at least?
I think there is a huge scope for policy reform. And not just because the UK government has asked for it, but also because there is a need to make European legislation more coherent, more legally certain, and also because there are other member states that are claiming for reform. And in fact, the Commission has for some years now a program of review of the whole legislation called REFIT. And in what concerns social legislation, by the end of this year, 2015, practically all legislation, and we're talking about 60 plus directives and regulations, will be reviewed, ex post, will be evaluated. And it's inevitable that out of that work, some proposals for revision will emerge. And in fact, the Commission has already proposed in the program for 2015 a major review of the regulation on the coordination of social security that deals with access to welfare benefits for migrants. But that's a different matter of fundamental changes like bans for 4 years or something. For instance, the issue of child benefits. One of the items I see in the manifesto of the Conservative Party was to ban child benefits for all those parents whose children lived abroad. That, I would say, it seems to be discriminatory. But the another thing is, can't we adjust the level of the child benefit to the standard of living in the country where the children actually live? That's a different matter. Mm-hmm. And that's policy reform. And that can be made looking at the rules as they exist and try to find some ways to find a compromise between the member states, where the UK, well, in this case, the UK will have allies in some Scandinavian countries, for instance, and it's possible to negotiate. Also on employment law, the Working Time Directive, it's up for review, as the Posted Workers Directive is up for review, and there will be scope for negotiation, and I'm sure the UK will make hear its voice, and arrangements can be fixed. Mm-hmm. But that's a different matter of repatriation of competences on employment law.
So the wise approach is actually do incremental policy change rather than topple the whole system or reform the system as a whole. I mean, Richard, you're here in the European Parliament. What were the sort of reactions of your peers to the demands of the new British government? Mm-hmm. And do you think rather than positioning the UK as one player who wants to extract concessions from 27 other member states, it would be wiser for Prime Minister Cameron to frame this differently, i.e. the European Union is in a reform process anyway, mm-hmm. so embed his demands in a wider reform agenda rather than saying it's me against everybody else and I need to show a victory in Britain.
Indeed, if he can portray his demands as being in the general interest and find allies rather than unilateral opt-outs, he will have a much more favourable reception. Just as we were saying, if he pitches it at policy change rather than treaty change, he will have a more favourable reception. Depending still, of course, on exactly what those changes are that he wants. You were touching on some of the social chapter legislation. There he has to be careful, not just because of reticence in other European countries, but the reaction back home if he wants to win his referendum. How do you motivate, for instance, British trade unionists to go out and vote for this reformed European Union if he's taken away their employment rights and social rights? You have to say, well, it's still better than being out, but it's a weakening of something they like, they strongly support. So it would be much more difficult to win the referendum if he were attacking rights which in some parts of Britain at least are very strongly supported.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back, for example, to the French referendum in 2005 on the constitutional treaty called the Constitution. People assume that President Chirac called it, he'd be backing it, of course. The French Socialist Party always claimed to be the most pro-European party in France. Mm-hmm. But then suddenly, when there was a chance to defeat an unpopular president, the French Socialist Party produced Laurent Fabius, who's not particularly left-wing. He made an alliance with Arnaud Montebourg, who's more left-wing. And then, of course, reached out to all the anti-Europeans, the so-called souverainists, the sovereignists, the people who believed in national sovereignty over Europe, and then no formal alliance, of course, with all the supporters of anti-European supporters of the Le Pen family. I don't know whether the papa or the daughter was in charge in those days. Mm. And bingo, you had an alliance sort of thrown together by people who opposed each other in every other sphere. Mm. But they just enjoyed defeating Chirac. I don't think they really cared about the content of the constitutional treaty because it came back, you know, 90% the same in the Lisbon Treaty. Mm-hmm. And that's what worries me. And I think Richard is right. The Prime Minister's got to be very careful not to say, right, we're going to weaken the Posted Workers Directive. Right, we're going to weaken the Working Time Directive. Right, Social Europe now is pushed onto the back burner, out of sight, hooray, the businessman will say, that every British worker and trade union person and Labour person can say, that's not our Europe, we vote against it. The politics of the referendum are separate from the technical details of what can be negotiated.
Because what he's putting on the table is not a choice between the status quo and his reforms, it's a choice between Cameron's Europe or no Europe. And at that point, he'll say to the British people, don't even think of leaving. It's economic suicide. It will be a political catastrophe. You better accept what I've negotiated. The status quo won't be an option. A different set of reforms won't be on offer. He'll say, you better accept this or it's a disaster. So it's a sort of blackmail. It's not nearly as democratic as it sounds at first sight.
I mean, what the election result also showed is that, in political terms at least, the United Kingdom is not that unified at the moment anymore. Mm-hmm. How do you see the different dynamics playing out in this referendum campaign, for instance, in Scotland? I mean, Scotland is more pro-European than England. Well, so how do you see this playing out?
He's not just risking the unity of the European Union, but of the United Kingdom's
it's
union.
It's a double constitutional issue.
Because there's a possibility that you could have a result where the UK overall votes no and Scotland votes yes, which would reignite, of course, the whole debate on Scottish independence.
Indeed, Richard, if I may, England narrowly votes no, but thanks to the Scots and the Welsh, the UK, I'm talking about a 51%, 49% result. I mean, we're now living... Richard and I, Henning, you as a very welcome German friend for the time being, in the disunited kingdom. The Scots played the Scottish nationalist card. Mr. Cameron played the English nationalist card. England now has gone deep Tory blue, except in London and the big conurbations. And so we are moving now, to a new constitutional settlement in Britain, except we don't know how to do that. We don't have a written constitution. We have no mechanism for redesigning what the United Kingdom should be. And this is part of that profound centrifugal force inside the old UK that now has been unleashed, not thanks to Mr. Cameron. There are other forces at play, but it'll be quite difficult to stop that. Again, why I think, you see, for the Scots, logically, they would want a Brexit, a vote to leave the EU, because then they will say, good, you English go off out of Europe. We Scots want a second referendum now to stay in the European Union. There's the result, the democratic result of the Scottish people, and you must give it to us, and that's the end. The Queen will no longer be able to go on holiday in her own United Kingdom.
Well, against this backdrop, and you mentioned policy reform requires coalitions and friendly other member states, where do you see, for instance, a coalition of member states to change social legislation, given bearing in mind that it is widely perceived on the continent, as far as I can tell, that Cameron wants to roll back social Europe, whereas quite a few other countries are quite keen to expand on the idea of a social Europe. So where do you see this tension?
Yeah. On employment legislation, traditionally the UK the UK government, I would say, had always a critical position. The dominant approach in the UK, according to government, has always been a voluntarist approach based on relations between individual employer and individual employee. And UK has been always very resistant to statutory law on employment. So I think the trade union movement in the UK is right to consider that the European legislation was the source of many of the rights now for UK workers, like paid leave and parental leave and equality of treatment for typical workers. But this led to confrontations in the Council between the UK and other member states, where very often the UK was isolated. Nowadays, after the enlargement of 2004, the situation is different, and the UK has managed to obtain allies, particularly among enlargement countries, and it's much easier to form blocking minorities to proposals extending employment legislation. I must say, given the situation in the Council, that that perspective is not a very realistic one. On the other hand, the Parliament, yes, the Parliament has been pushing the Commission to present proposals to correct asymmetries, to give more protection to workers, for instance, zero-hour contracts and the types of flexible contracts that deprive workers of any rights. But not in the Council, no. In the Council, there is not much appetite for expanding social legislation. On the other hand, if you take welfare benefits, I think the setup is completely different, because there the allies that could help the UK to introduce restrictions to access to welfare benefits are to be found in the north of Europe, but opponents in the enlargement countries that would not like to see their nationals being barred access to social housing or to child benefits. So it's going to be interesting to see how the diplomacy in the Council will evolve with the two blocks of potential allies, but that they are not the same, depending on which issue you're going to discuss, either social security coordination or employment legislation, because the blocks are completely different. Mm-hmm. And I just would add that I think the UK government has been, over the ages, relatively successful in obtaining derogations and special conditions in the Council for employment directives. But the influence of the UK is much less in the Parliament or among the social partners, who have a very important role as consulted bodies, as negotiators as well, if they wish, for social legislation. But in the Council, I think the UK has been quite successful in the past, and we have plenty of examples. I mean, the opt-out from the Working Time Directive 48 hours limit is the main example, but there are others. But that influence is not paralleled by influence, I think, in the Parliament or among the social partners.
But I think he realizes this is a minefield, domestically and in European terms. And I think if you look at what he's been saying in the last few days about the thrust of his reform demands, they are keeping away from the social field. I think, you can never tell with Mr. Cameron, next week he may say something completely different. But at the moment, he's steering away from a head-on attack on the social chapter.
Mm-hmm. And let's broaden this to the general question of European reform. I mean, Britain is not the only construction site in the European Union. Obviously, a very big one is the Eurozone. Against the backdrop of the troubles of the Eurozone, where do you think are we headed? Are we now headed towards a European Union that is clearly multi-layered, multi-level? Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes people say, is there a vanguard and a group
legged,
in the Euro? But no, I think we have different arrière-garde. But the composition differs depending on the subject. Several countries are not in the Euro. Cyprus, Ireland, UK not in Schengen. Spain and Italy not in the patent court system. Denmark not in European defence. You'll notice that each time it's a smaller group and it's a different configuration. And let's not forget the bulk of what the EU does is done at the level of the whole EU, all 28 countries. The big glue is the single European market and the legislation for that market on consumer protection, environmental standards, competition policy, some workers' rights. That will remain the case. So I don't buy in too much to this idea that there's going to be a hardcore developing around the euro or around defense or whatever. No.
Not even if the eurozone reform effectively might require some more fiscal integration than clearly
well,
other
the eurozone's
member states.
Been discussing that for several years now. And what they found is that they can do a lot of... It's true the countries that share a currency have to do more together to manage that currency, but most of what they've done has been within the context of the current treaties. And there's no proposal on the table at the moment to have a new treaty. The things which they can't do without changing the treaty are things for which there is, in any case, no consensus, and you need consensus to change the treaty. So I think they're going to deepen, but within the current framework for the foreseeable future.
So the lack of deepening within the current framework might be one of the reasons why the crisis is rambling on. Dennis, do you think that this Europe à la carte, different groups doing different things together, is sustainable in the long run?
Well, as an element of differentiation, you're not going to abolish the nations of Europe, the nation states of Europe, the national parliaments of Europe if you're deeply resentful that they're excluded from decision-making and decision-taking. And the European Parliament, I know we're sitting in it, but proportionally it does have rather a large number of fairly unsavoury populist groups represented here. To my British eyes, maybe if you're used to Trotskyists and communists and anti-Semites and racists, it's not a problem. And so I think that part of the reform agenda that says national parliaments should be more involved, have more say, I think it's very positive. But to get there, you actually have to start cooperating. National parliamentarians in the House of Commons, the Assemblée Nationale, the Cortes, the Bundestag have to start finding ways of working a bit more together to achieve common ends. I mean, there is a lot of reform that's needed. The crying reform, for heaven's sake, is the mass unemployment in much of Europe, the horrible youth unemployment, the stagnation of too many of our economies. Today we hear that the German growth in the first quarter is 0.3%. Well, that's some Wirtschaftswunder, isn't it? France, twice as good, 0.6%. 0.6%? That's not going to create jobs. And there, really, I don't blame that. It's not the Commission or the European Parliament, but it, somehow there's a disconnect between what needs to be done and what actually is done. And I think Europe, even if Britain stays in after a grumpy, bad-tempered referendum, there'll be another crisis just round the corner because Europe collectively, the 27 member states, just don't know how to get an act together. I mean, look at the way they let the Greeks suffer endlessly and pointlessly for a few billion euros. I mean, this is sort of housekeeping politics of the worst sort.
Mm. Richard, I mean, obviously, giving national parliaments a bigger say in EU policymaking is one of the arguments being pushed forward by the Labour government. How do you see that work as a member of the European Parliament?
There's nothing whatsoever to prevent him making a start on that at home, reinstating the debates ahead of a European Council meeting that he scrapped. Why not follow the Nordic model where any minister going next week to a council meeting goes the week before to the relevant parliamentary committee and says, look, this is what's on the agenda, this is the position I'm intending to take, and they can shape the position that he or she takes before the minister goes to Brussels rather than hearing about it afterwards. There's nothing to stop that.
So it's much more communication exercise than anything else.
No, it's more than communication. It's a
hypocrisy exercise, Henning. Yeah. I mean, really, and you know, I was Europe minister and I tried so hard, but you can bring a parliament to water, but you can't make it think. And people just weren't prepared to change their minds. Anybody who travelled abroad, went to Paris or Brussels, was accused of being a junketeer. Their expenses were held up for ridicule and examination. Whereas you can travel anywhere inside the UK as an MP, but the moment you cross over to another European country, then you're seen as a sort of being on permanent holiday. Yeah. There's a whole approach that needs to be changed, and frankly, it is pure hypocrisy of this Prime Minister, or other ones, I'm not singling out Mr. Cameron, to say we need more authority and purpose and role for national parliaments while doing nothing to actually initiate that yourself using your own authority as Prime Minister and getting your own Parliament to take a more active and intelligent interest in European affairs.
Okay, we're already running out of time. Let's have a final round. Aminda, when you think forward, a year from now, where do you think we are?
It's difficult to say before we see the agenda that the UK government will present to Europe.
But do you think the demands will be toned down from what was in the manifesto?
Well, I think for me, it's clear that some of those demands imply treaty change. And there is a strategic option to be made. I'm sure that has also to lead to exchanges between European Union institutions and the leaders of the European institutions and the UK Prime Minister, because nobody, I think, wants to have a complete flop. And now it's the worst that can happen to Europe. There are already so many problems on other grounds. So I think some negotiation behind the curtains, I would say, would be necessary to avoid a clash where UK says this must be done and Europe says no talk about treaty change. We don't want that. As yesterday in the meeting, ECOFIN ministers said very bluntly. Now, on the side of the Commission, as I said before, there will be a handful of proposals on the table that will initiate policy reform and a number of bills that are important for the UK. I mentioned already access to welfare benefits is important. And eventually next year, also on some parts of labour legislation need to be made fitter. I don't talk about deregulation or reduction of social rights because, I mean, the evidence that we have about more precarity, more inequality, do not invite an agenda of deregulation and scrapping social rights. On the contrary. We have scope to make the application of some of legislation less costly for business, but maintaining a very sound level of protection for workers. For instance, on health and safety, and that has been discussed, there is a big evaluation going on now that will produce results by the beginning of next year. And there will be certainly scope for some consolidation or rationalization of the acquis, but without threatening the basic principle that whatever the size of the company, every worker must be protected against toxic products and risky conditions of work, of course. Mm-hmm. But if there are ways to implement those rules which are more business friendly, yes, let's see how to do it. This is the kind of discussion that I think there should be, I would like to be seen in 1 year's time, and not fundamental tectonic changes, repatriation of powers, but try to see what has worked well, what has not worked so well and must be changed. And that's where I think I would like the discussion to be in 1 year's time. Mm-hmm.
A sensible agenda for policy change. Yeah, is this to happen?
I mean, that's all well and good, but it's in large part what the EU is going about doing anyway, and Mr. Cameron's right-wing backbenchers want something more spectacular. They want blood on the carpet. They want something much more visible. They want treaty change or whatever. You can do a lot of reforms and dress it up as a special package without changing the treaty. If Mr. Cameron manages to get away with doing that, if his party will allow him to do that, he can come back and say, look, we've achieved this, that, and the other. It will make the European Union work much better. We've got some extra safeguards on this and that in everybody's interest. Then maybe he'll get away with it. But he's gambling everything on this. He's gambling a heck of a lot, the future of our country and the future of Europe.
Dennis, in a year's time, we might be in the middle of a referendum campaign. It is really being brought forward to the end of 2016. Is he gambling the house?
I think he is. I think bringing it forward makes sense because his popularity will just go down very, very fast, I'm afraid, with a huge economic and social tensions and problems in the UK, pushing it to 2017, the election year for Mrs. Merkel and François Hollande, I think is crazy to mix up the British one. He needs to keep it as low-key as possible. Will he be allowed to do that? Because he raised the temperature. He offered this in-out Brexit plebiscite in 2013. In that speech, interestingly, the word immigrant and immigration wasn't mentioned. Since then, people have been told, rightly, that under EU rules, you cannot limit immigration, and immigration in all of our countries. Think of the Tea Party in America for Europeans. Think of the Netherlands, Denmark, Germany, France. Immigration is today's most toxic political subject. It's the Ebola virus of modern politics. It kills everything it touches. And quite clearly, I think we're all agreed, and Mr. Cameron actually doesn't seem any longer to be calling for controls on immigration, though some MEPs are, that this also needs to be put on the table. But the people are going to wake up and say, all your MPs and ministers were saying the only way to control immigration is to get a treaty change and remove the free movement of people. You haven't brought that back home. We're not interested in your tiddlywink little changes and the promise of reviews and this directive's going to be examined in a year's time. You've let us down. You've betrayed us.
Which is precisely his own mistake, what you were saying earlier, of talking things up.
Yeah.
Most migrants to Britain are from outside the EU, nothing to do with the EU and entirely a matter of national regulation. But in talking up the problem of the free circulation within the European Union as the biggest aspect of migration, he's created, with UKIP, this perception. Within the EU, there are as many Brits abroad as there are people from other European countries in Britain. So it's not a question of the numbers. They pay in Britain one-third more in taxes, EU migrants, than they take out in services and benefits added together. So it's not a problem of public finances. There are particular problems, most of which you can deal with under national legislation, or perhaps by tweaking some of the EU directives, legislation. You do not need a treaty change for this
and
to address it properly.
You don't need a referendum. I mean, this is the extraordinary thing. Yeah. This is not part of the British Constitution. You must have a referendum on any new treaty proposal, like is the case in Ireland, Denmark, some other countries. This is a self-generated, populist, politically opportunistic plebiscite, which I hope doesn't, but I fear may rebound horribly against us as a nation. And Mr. Cameron may go off soon. He's announced he's not going to stand at the next election. He can go off and retire. He's not a poor man. But Britain outside Europe will be in a catastrophic situation. And Europe minus Britain will also, I think, be increase the disintegrative forces in Europe. So there are very, very high stakes here. And personally, starting this process, I'm not sure whether we should up the ante by saying this is historically of great importance, or hope if we softly we can sneak in, we put on our socks and slippers and we can quietly get some deal, and that will be enough to keep Britain inside. I'm frankly very, very frightened for my country's future.
Well, whether you like it or not, we have a referendum at our hands, but I'm afraid this is all we have time for today. I'm sure this is not the last time we're going to discuss this topic as the political events unfold. You can comment on this program using the hashtag SetBritain, S-E-T-Britain, and please also subscribe to our YouTube channel so you can watch future programs. Thank you and goodbye.